been pouring my slops down your chimney. The amazed recognition in that old man's voice in this particular sentence makes that sentence my favorite part of the entire story. Ah, I've been pouring my slops down your chimney. In life, as in story, it's rarely enough for us simply to hear from someone else that our comfort is leading to their discomfort. No matter how many times they tell us, we often have to see for ourselves the actual consequences of our choices and of our actions. But why is it that we pour our slops down each other's chimneys in the first place? Now, the old couple in the story are simply minding their own business and taking care of their lives with the minimum of fuss and bother. They're completely unaware of their neighbors on the other side of the wall. Now, of course, these are not neighbors that we might immediately recognize as such. Rather, the neighbors in the story are the wee folk whose households and economies are invisible to the old man even when he is told where to look. In fact, without special assistance, he might never have noticed that they were there at all. Now, in a similar way, it's been common practice in Western culture not to see the homes or the lifeways of the poor, or of people of color, or of First Nations peoples, or of the native plant and animal ecologies that surround us, for that matter. And that frees us to blithely dump our slops over the wall and into the weeds. As a culture, our focus has been on ourselves and our convenience, and that is facilitated by our inability or unwillingness to see those who are right next door. I wonder why that's so. In the opening pages of his book, Deep Economy, writer Bill McKibben writes, "For most of human history, two birds, more and better, have roosted together on the same branch. You could toss one stone and hope to hit them both. More food, more shelter, more stuff, more mobility, these without a doubt made life better. And since more is easier to quantify than better, and since more initially leads to better, as in better health and a better standard of living, governments and cultures around the world started to focus on making sure that everyone had more. And since more is something that can be measured by individuals and households, and in the lives of individuals and households, that's how it's been done for at least a couple hundred years. But as it turns out, better and more no longer roost on the same branch. All over the world, the studies show that at the point where you have about $10,000 per person, and that's all, $10,000 per person, enough to cover basic needs, when that happens, better moves to a different tree. It isn't news that after our basic needs are met, food, clothing, housing, health care, happiness is more a matter of the intangibles, more closely related to deeper connections, stronger relationships, a vibrant common, a cleaner environment, more meaning. And it turns out that our individualistic pursuit of more money, more stuff, more convenience, ends up consuming a lot of the things that we actually need for better. And creating a whole lot of slops and the need to find a place to put them in the process. I know that all of you know about peak oil, that point in time in the not too distant future when our fossil fuel consumption will peak and the oil reserves of our planet, the fossilized sunlight of millions of years, will be half depleted. Well, I'm looking forward to the moment of peak stuff. That moment when we cease to see those slops as waste to be thrown away and start to see them as resources to be composted for the garden, to be fed to the pig. I look forward to that time when we're going to stop buying things to use and throw away, and instead we'll start investing our time and creativity and energy into creating durable objects, healthy ecologies, stronger, resilient relationships and communities. What we need in order to get there, I think, is a perceptual shift. We need to put our foot on the little man's foot so that we can see with new eyes. Now, I was an artist and an art teacher in a previous career, lo, these many years ago. And one of the things I remember and I learned is that when you've been staring at a painting or drawing for a long time, it gets so you can't see it very well. And there are a couple of tricks that artists use. One thing you do is you look at it in a mirror, so you see it in reverse. The other thing you do is you turn it upside down. Shifting our focus from a world where more is the goal to a world where better is the goal is one way to make that perceptual shift. Another way is reading our Unitarian Universalist principles from bottom to top, beginning with our communal disciplines and ending with our individual ones. What happens when we do that? Well, on one level, nothing. All the same words and ideas are still there on the page. But on the other level, there's a difference. When we affirm and promote the respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part first, and leave celebrating the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And there's a parenthesis at that that you never see. It says, especially me. If we leave that till the end. I'm intrigued by the reversal, because I think that we as Unitarian Universalists get stuck in that first principle an awful lot of the time. In our voluntary associations, we come and go according to whether we feel that our inherent worth and dignity, our perspective and opinion, is accorded its full due. But friends, just as the life that you are living here and now is your best, perhaps your only chance for spiritual practice and self-realization, here in Boise, the Unitarian Universalist congregation gathered in this room is the best, perhaps the only community that you have at present in which to explore and live those Unitarian Universalist values which we care about so deeply. This is it. And I suspect, although I haven't a smattering of proof, I suspect that if we were to start reading our principles in that reverse order and then living our principles in that reverse order, beginning with the shared community and ending with the personal, I think we will find ourselves in the midst of a transformation that surprises us. I suspect that by focusing at least as much on the intangibles that come with respect for that interdependent web as we do on the inherent worth and dignity of me, we will unconsciously shift our focus from more to better. Not more money and more people and more programming, but better communication, deeper ritual, stronger connection, and a greater positive impact on the world outside our walls. I suspect that we will find ourselves focused on satisfying our communally held needs for meaning and culture and relationship. When we turn the principles upside down, we're called back to that old slogan, think globally, but act locally. We're reminded that when we dump our slops, we need to check and see who's living on the other side of that garden wall. You never leave community, really. We're always embedded in it. And that's a good thing, because that means that when we tend community, we support our own well-being in turn. Creating stronger relationships and a vibrant common gives all of us and each of us a better quality of life. Tend the better in the community, tend the commons, and we arrive at something that is just naturally better for the individual. Now, when we look back at the origins of Unitarian Universalism and at how our values came to be articulated in the world, it's important to remember that they were articulated during the Enlightenment, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And at that point in time, even the wealthiest of our Unitarian and Universalist forebears were materially quite poor. To walk through Thoreau's cottage or Emerson's home or the Alcott House, if you visit New England, is to be reminded that while these people were spiritually and relationally and intellectually rich, they were materially poor by our standards. In that time, our forebears took for granted their highly interconnected, carefully choreographed community. And their emphasis on the worth and dignity of the individual was a corrective in a time when it was needed. It was a corrective to the privileging of some classes of human beings over others, and it was a corrective to the impulse to devalue humankind for the first time as cogs in this growing industrial machine. What they took for granted, that interdependent web of relationships that they had with each other and with the places they live, we have almost lost in our intensely competitive pursuit of the individual good. And so what we need in our time, in our place, is a different kind of corrective. I'm persuaded that much of the harm that we do to ourselves and to others falls into the category of unintended side effects. Slops dumped over the wall unknowingly. Our forebears never dreamed that honoring the inherent worth and dignity of every person would result in anything like the hyper-individualism and disconnection of our 21st century culture. It never occurred to them that human agency could create global warming, or decimate local food sheds, or destroy the relational fabric of our communities. It never occurred to them that we would forfeit the goods that they took for granted in our pursuit of more stuff, more choices, or more convenience. My hypothesis is that if we Unitarian Universalists reverse the order of our principles, we'll shift our goals and our focus from more for me to better for us, and the unintended results and the unintended side effects will be healthier for all concerned. It's interesting to think what that might look like. I think it would look like choosing to inconvenience ourselves just a little bit more for the good of the larger community. I preached a Mother's Day sermon last spring where I suggested that the willingness to be inconvenienced might be one of the strongest indicators of parental love. Well, this morning I want to suggest that a willingness to be inconvenienced in support of our values is a parallel marker of how strong our commitment is to those values that we espouse. To live from respect for the interdependent web looks like accepting the inconvenience of cutting a back door in your house and carrying the slops out the other way. It looks like taking the extra time to bike or carpool to work or to worship. It looks like growing a garden and canning your produce, or going to a CSA or a farmer's market. It looks like making a hot dish or a salad and coming to potluck or community dinner instead of eating fast food by yourself. It looks like turning off the TV and schlepping out in the weather to sing in the choir or play in the band or play cards with your friends. It looks like walking in the mountains and picking up the trash and spotting some wonderful wild creature dashing through the shadows. It looks like hand-me-downs from the neighbor across the street and recycled or repurposed clothing purchased from the vendor that you're getting to know by name. It looks like a creative emphasis on things that are local and sustainable and homegrown. It looks like volunteers working to keep the elderly in their homes. It looks like celebrating each other's milestones and learning about our varied cultures and faith traditions and practicing compassionate communication. It looks like voting and marching and concerts. It looks like kids learning to slow down and walk when older adults are present. It looks like adults learning to listen through the background chatter of young voices. Your inherent worth and dignity remains important. You don't have to give that up. And you don't have to give up imported bananas or coffee or chocolate. You don't have to silence your needs or stifle your own feelings or become a doormat for other people to walk over. What you do need to do is be willing to flex a little bit more and go out of your way to act for the good of the group first, trusting that acting for the good of your neighbor will indeed benefit you by and by. McKibben writes, "You need to reorient your personal compass just a little bit. You need to shed a certain amount of your hyper-individualism and replace it with a certain amount of neighborliness. You need to think of yourself as a member of the community. That way, you get a better deal, and you help to build a world with some hope of ecological stability, where the chances increase that you and your children will be happy." Turns out that human happiness is that tiny silver coin that rolls beneath the door when the door is opened to the interdependent web of all existence. To find human happiness, to find our own happiness, what better place to start than reorienting our principles and beginning to live in a new way? Blessed be.